Okay, it's terrific to have Professor Gordon Parker here tonight. I've followed his work at Black Dog Institute forever, and Peter Joseph, who's here, is a great supporter of the Black Dog Institute and Gordon. This work that he's talking about isn't the Institute that he was so famous for, but it's about someone who was very famous, Winston Churchill, and his connection to mental health. But I won't tell you what's coming. Gordon will. Welcome to you, Gordon.
So thank you, Anne and Gerard, for the invitation. And it's a prestigious institute. It's had some great people speak over time, so it's a great privilege. So in considering whether Winston Churchill had a bipolar disorder, I need to emphasise that any such judgment should not diminish him. In fact, the opposite. Along with so many people with a bipolar disorder, his achievements in depth and breadth were extraordinary, and Churchill has long been one of my heroes, and I still remember reading the four-volume History of the English-Speaking Peoples in my final year at school and just marvelling at the language. Where would we be now if he'd not led the Allies to an unpredictable victory in World War II? And another mark of my respect was our naming of a new clinical research facility a couple of decades back, the Black Dog Institute, and with John Bevans, who's in the audience, doing the most magical logo, capturing both Churchill with the V for victory, creating a shadow of a black dog. But while Churchill popularised the black dog metaphor, he borrowed it from Johnson and Boswell, who both suffered from depression. But it actually had much earlier origins, stretching back into ancient Celtic times when people would describe their depression as a black dog or a black fog. And now many people actually will talk about, when they have the type of depression we're talking about, a black hole. So the black is a very evocative descriptor. In seeking to put the argument that he had a bipolar condition, I had several options. One was to write a book, but then I'd be at the end of a queue of more than 700 biographies that have been written on Churchill. Two, to write a scientific article. There are some word limit problems that come into play. I chose a third option, to write a play, fallback film, fallback TV series, fallback Netflix, but more shortly. But first, let me define the bipolar disorders. Once we allowed only one, and it was called manic depressive illness, a psychotic condition which we now call bipolar 1. Bipolar 2, which is the non-psychotic variant, has, like bipolar 1, existed forever. We can find people with the condition going back for centuries. But it only received diagnostic status in the mid-90s. And it was previously positioned in people who showed such characteristics as more reflecting a personality style, which was called cyclothymia. Both bipolar 1 and bipolar 2 have very strong genetic origins. Good morning. Hi, Tim. Both conditions comprise phases of moods that we call highs and lows. During depressive episodes, the individual is in a state of despair. Suicidal thoughts are common, and it's interesting to note that while bipolar 2 is often seen as a milder condition than bipolar 1, the suicide rate is actually higher in bipolar 2 than in bipolar 1, largely because people precipitously go from high into a depression. People in this type of bipolar depressive phase have an inability to experience pleasure or to be cheered up. They have a lack of energy, causing them to find it hard to get out of bed. They often just lie in bed, or if they get out of bed, they just go and lie on the lounge. And for some, they may lie there for weeks or months in the desperate state. So their lack of energy is highly salient. Foggy concentration is not in the textbooks, but it's actually a key marker of the melancholic depressive subtype. People not able to take in information or remember it. Mood and energy tend to be worse in the morning, getting better as the day goes on, and there's obviously appetite and sleep disturbances. during such state, sufferers lose the light in their eyes. It's quite a fascinating phenomenon. And it probably reflects some of the dopamine receptors in the retina being compromised. Then during the up phases, which in bipolar 2 we call hypomanic, and in bipolar 1 states we call manic, most individuals are extremely happy, but a small percentage can instead be snappy. And for example, Spike Milligan, one of nature's most gentlest human beings, would actually take an axe to his neighbor's property when he went psychotically manic. And in fact, his bipolar disorder, which was in deep play for 40 years and ended up with multiple treatments, including deep sleep therapy at one stage, was captured in a play called Ying Tong, just down the road at the Sydney Theatre Company in 2007. Also, another exemplar of the people who get snappy rather than happy was Lord Byron, who famously evoked, you know, the statement that he was mad, bad, and dangerous to know. During highs of whatever type, whether it's bipolar 1 or bipolar 2, people talk more. They more commonly tend to talk over others as well. They spend more money. It can be at a low level. A woman heading out to buy a pair of shoes might buy a dozen. Somebody else might buy, say, oh, I think I better, I need a new car, and then get, okay, I'll go, it's going to be a Porsche. Get to the showroom, I don't know which colour I get, so I'll get a yellow and a green and a black and a white, etc. They need less sleep without feeling tired. Their worries disappear like snow on a summer's day. They have increased libido, which causes immense problems for so many. They feel and are generally distinctly more creative. They tend to feel bulletproof, and they take more risks. Their eyes are bright and sparkling. And in fact, sometimes in that high state, their eyes can change colour. So those with blue eyes can actually change to black. They can also drink more alcohol, some seemingly turning wine into water. And I had a patient who, when she was in a normal mood state, mid-20s, she could only drink 3 glasses of wine without being tipsy. When she was high, she could drink 2 bottles of wine and half a bottle of vodka and be totally coherent. They not uncommonly experience suprasensory phenomenon. So I can still remember at Prince of Wales Hospital, a patient telling me he could hear all the traffic on Barker Street, and I couldn't hear a thing. They can smell things that we can't smell generally. One man said he was buying his coffee in the morning and he trod on some dog feces. He wiped it all off, but the smell remained with him all day. Taste becomes strikingly rich. One woman described an ability to listen to an orchestra and then deconstruct and attend to each instrument and then reconstruct the orchestra again. And a key phenomenon that can occur, and very relevant to tonight's topic, is distinctive prescience. So many judging that they're aware of events before they actually occur and sometimes able to shape them. The official classificatory manuals for the bipolar, hypomanic and manic states say that they are impairing, impairing by definition. In reality, quite the opposite. In a study we recently published, some 60% of individuals with a bipolar disorder reported improved performance during a high. And last year I had a year 12 student who was given 6 assignments to do over the next 8 weeks. She did them all in 3 days, didn't go to bed or sleep at all over those 3 days and 3 nights, and got top marks in every one that she submitted. Another example is Joshua Logan. He took 18 months in a normal mood state to produce the musical South Pacific. And then a couple of years later, when he was in a manic state, he produced Charlie's Aunt in 3 days to equal critical acclaim. But that night, the opening night, he tried to fly out of his hotel window, believing that he was potentially immortal. And thus the hypomanic, manic mood states with the increased energy, creativity, suprasensory phenomena and prescience helped to explain why successful writers, poets, composers, artists, comedians, and those in other creative fields are 3 times to 6 times more likely to have a bipolar disorder. And also explaining why so many brilliant business entrepreneurs and politicians have a bipolar disorder. In relation to politicians, psychiatrist Jonathan Davidson wrote a book called Downing Street Blues and suggested that the first 51 British prime ministers, 16% had a bipolar disorder, none of them losing office and most being judged as superior to the effective control group of mentally healthy prime ministers. Nor would any have received a diagnosis of bipolar 2 at that time because, as I mentioned earlier, it hadn't hit the classificatory manuals. So turning to Churchill, what is the evidence and, more importantly, what can we learn from the linkage, in particular from his actions as a warrior? Firstly, I mentioned that there's a strong genetic contribution to the bipolar disorders, with families having a bipolar representative more likely to have representation of bipolar disorder or depressive disorders by a factor of about 10. The hereditability is around about 80%. So turning to Churchill, 5 of Churchill's Duke of Marlborough ancestors had manic depressive condition, while one of his children, Diana, who worked for a long time for the Samaritans, which was an anti-suicide organisation in London, committed suicide at the age of 54. So he had ancestors with manic depressive illness, and he obviously it continued through the family. For the play/film Netflix exercise, I chose to focus on 2 World War I chapters, the Dardanelles Gallipoli campaign, especially in light of the Australian connection, and secondly, on Antwerp. I came up with 5 characters: Winston, his wife Clementine, his private secretary Edward Marsh, who viewed Churchill as England's greatest leader since King Alfred, Jackie Fisher, who was the first Sea Lord brought back into play by Churchill, grandiose and complimenting Winston, the two operating as port and starboard lights before their fallout, and Violet Asquith, who was the daughter of then Prime Minister Asquith, who later, as Violet Bonham Carter, published one of the warmest biographies of Churchill in 1965. Violet fell in love with Winston when she was when they first met. She was 19, he was 32, and she was convinced that he was going to marry her. The weekend he was supposed to attend their place in Scotland, he didn't turn up. Winston, as usual, was opening up a second front. He went to see Clementine, and Violet made a suicide attempt. For years, Violet, who was Winston's conduit to the Prime Minister, and Winston's wife Clementine sought to tear each other's eyes out, but didn't, because after all they were English. And thus I called the play/film Churchill's Gallipoli, and it did the circuit, having a chance when an Australian film company sent it to their London office with a recommendation, but it was then turned down, as there was a judgment that there'd been too many films on Churchill. After a reading of the play by one theatre company a couple of years back, I judged it was a bit too didactic and in need of colour, and so I added a 6th character, Boris Johnson, set at the time that he was Lord Mayor, and for a number of reasons. Firstly, his 2014 biography is one of the best biographies of Churchill, and a manageable text of only 400 pages. Most reviewers of his book identified his clear self-percept as being the next Churchill, providing a comparator Boris going through the play, now titled Winston and Boris, disclaiming any such view while constantly referencing multiple positive reviews of his book. An example and an actual Boris quote: "My chances as a future Prime Minister are about as good as the chances of finding Elvis on Mars or of me being decapitated by a frisbee." Further dissembling, he emphasises he was essentially just a journalist, which he defines as a job where you're given a huge dumper truck of verbal gravel and then you have to know how to pick out the pebbles to create the mosaic. Secondly, in the play, he acts like a Shakespearean fool of the intellectual Verian class, and I reworked many of his real rollicking one-liners to achieve some relevance. Thirdly, there's a faint interconnection in that his paternal great-grandfather, an Anglophile Turkish polemicist, was waiting in Constantinople at the time of the Dardanelles campaign. Unfortunately, because he was a journalist and provocative, a bit like Boris, and took on Ataturk, he was hung from a tree a few years later. And fourthly, there is the shared issue of prescience, which I'll detail shortly. So let me provide you with an extract of scene one as I see it. It's September 2014. Winston is the First Lord of the Admiralty. He's in his bathroom in silk pajamas, towel over one shoulder, phone in hand, next to a full bath. During the scene, he knocks boats out of the bath in anger. He roars into the phone, "Admiral Craddock, you must protect the French transport ships from von Spee's attacks. No, you're not to wait orders from Battenberg. No, you're still working out a strategy. I am not usurping my authority. I'm ensuring the job gets done. I'm the First Lord of the Admiralty and you do what I say, Craddock. Your vessels are not obsolete and stop telling me your men are inexperienced. I'm ordering you to meet von Spee and the Germans in company. You will not wait for the reinforcements. You will proceed now. Ignore my previous telegrams. This is a new direction on directions for engagement, and stop interrupting me when I'm interrupting you." Winston calls to the side, "Get the Prime Minister on the phone. I don't care if he's going to see the King. This is more important. It doesn't matter what they say. It's what I say. I'm the one in charge. We will go forward and forward without fear. The price of greatness is responsibility." Boris enters the stage riding a push bike. He lets it drop. He tosses his helmet onto a table, knocking over glasses and plates. "The 2014 Battle of Coronel off Chile, England's worst naval disaster in 100 years. Winston had the fleet going one way and then the other, creating total confusion and overriding his lines of authority. The outcome, tragic. 1,600 British officers and men dead, including Admiral Craddock, and two German ships getting through to Constantinople appeared certain to bring Turkey into the war on Germany's side, led to him bringing back Lord Fisher as he thought the Admiralty was ossified. But what energy did Churchill, this man, have? He would whir into the night as though a battery was made of some superior mixture of chemicals unknown to man. What sort of fuel did he run on? Was his superior internal combustion genetically endowed or a consequence of childhood conditioning?" Back to me. The point I make here is that Churchill was a politician, and his role as First Lord of the Admiralty was essentially to ensure that the fleet was equipped, not to engage in any of the operations. Here he usurped the appointed lead of the Navy, First Sea Lord Craddock, leading to calamitous losses to the British Navy and the future risk of Turkey joining with Germany. Not in and of itself proof of a hypomanic high, but quite compatible and supported by his bathroom tirade, evidencing grandiosity and entitlement, mood markers of a high. Let me note some other observations made about Churchill in World War I. Lloyd George described how he and his wife were sitting in dead silence as Big Ben struck 11 and the war was announced, that Churchill had raced into their room radiant and with words pouring out after each other as to how he's going to send telegrams to the Mediterranean, the North Sea, and God knows where. Lloyd George stated that he couldn't determine what was the more disquieting of the two events, war being declared or Churchill being quite mad. A few years later, Lloyd George likened Churchill to a chauffeur who's apparently perfectly sane and drives with great skill for months and then suddenly takes people over a precipice. At an Admiralty dinner at the beginning of World War I, Churchill was described as radiating a vainglorious and grandiose mood. And this is a quote, "This, my God, is living history. Everything we are doing and saying is thrilling. It will be read by a thousand generations. I would not be out of this glorious, delicious war for anything the world could give me." Mood swings were evident during his escape during the Boer War, when he would run through the forest feeling intense exhilaration. And his prescience probably came into play when he saw the light on the hill. Lord Beaverbrook captured the pattern as well as any other observer in describing Churchill as either at the top of the wheel of confidence or at the bottom of an intense depression. Let me now focus on the World War I Dardanelles campaign. Churchill again sought to open up a second front via the Dardanelles and the Gallipoli Peninsula and seize Constantinople, a strategy to be implemented via the Navy, but for Churchill without any troops, despite everyone saying you cannot go in there without troops. Churchill said, we'll go in without troops if I can't have them. Admiral Fisher judged it as a lunatic idea. Once again, as First Lord of the Admiralty, Churchill's only job was to ensure that the fleet was equipped, not to undertake or intrude on operational matters. Churchill at that time overrode everyone, leading to Fisher resigning. Churchill says there are many people can rat, but to re-rat is pretty impressive. He talked about the Dardanelles campaign on radio, effectively warning the Turks what was up. He made a foraging attack on the forts, which then allowed the Turks plenty of time to further ensure that the forts were further enhanced. So he gave the Turks plenty of time to reinforce their guns and troops and to lay mines, which hadn't been present there. In March 1915, he ordered the Navy to proceed without troops. He ignored the technical issues about shelling put to him by experts, that shells actually go up and straight down, so that shelling the forts failed completely. The Navy prioritised removal of the mines and sent Churchill 5 requests for specialist minesweepers. Churchill couldn't wait. He called on inadequate trawlers manned by amateur fishermen, and most were swept away by the currents or killed by the Turks. Then he ordered the fleet in. A fleet of 16 battleships, 12 cruisers and 22 destroyers sailed into the straits. Less than 7 hours later, one third of the fleet was lost, 700 sailors killed, and Admiral de Roebuck recalled the fleet. And with such disastrous decision-making continuing right through the Dardanelles campaign through to Gallipoli. But let me turn to a more persuasive exemplar of Churchill's hypomanic behaviour. In the previous year, Churchill sought to address the stalemate on the Western Front. He asked Foreign Minister Grey if he could go to Antwerp and decided against taking professional troops. He was going to take his own Royal Naval Volunteer Reserves, essentially vulnerable amateurs, including Rupert Brooke. The Marine Brigade were, under Churchill's orders, to provide a distraction to the Germans by marching backwards and forwards, north to south, east to west across Antwerp, supported by London Piccadilly buses commandeered by Churchill to confuse the Germans. Churchill acted like a traffic controller offering endless commands in a crazy mix of English and French. Many of the reserves died and more than 1,000 were taken prisoner, and Antwerp fell shortly to the Germans. Next, enjoying himself so much that after only 36 hours at Antwerp, Churchill telegraphed Prime Minister Asquith requesting permission to resign from the Admiralty and continue in command of all British forces in Antwerp and to have the rank of Major General, after referring to Britain's most distinguished military leaders as mediocrities and, quotes, dugout trash. In response, the press at that time described him as a posturing military adventurer and emphasised that his place should be at the Admiralty day and night. Asquith was struck by his impudence and disinhibition, reporting that he, quotes, showed a zigzag streak of lightning in his brain and called it, quotes, a wicked folly. Lloyd George criticised him publicly for leaving untrained men in the lurch. Captain Richard Richmond reported back from Antwerp, I really believe Churchill is not sane, that the Navy was in lunatic hands, and at that time Bonner Law stated that Antwerp evidenced Churchill's, quotes, entirely unbalanced mind. In his book, Boris Johnson stated it was an enterprise so incompetent that it made the charge of the Light Brigade appear positively slick. So what determined such calamitous outcomes in World War I and such brilliant and ever-inspiring victories in World War II under Churchill's leadership? I offer a personal view. His peers knew that there was a mental or personality problem in World War I, but they didn't know what it was or how to address it. In World War II, and again without any awareness of a bipolar II condition, because no such diagnosis had been brought into play, as I've mentioned, minders were put into place to check every one of his major decisions. So Montgomery said publicly that he would refuse to accept any order from Churchill unless it had been passed through a set of minders. So effectively, a stay-well plan, which is a component of any management plan for somebody with a bipolar disorder. You know, you identify the early signs and you have previously agreed on strategies in place put into operation. Just as an exemplar, one of my patients who was a doctor had a bipolar disorder, and he was one afternoon telling me he was quite suicidal and that he had a Beretta at home. So I said to him at the end of the session, you have to hand over your gun. Next week, when he turned up for the following week's appointment, he handed a Beretta to my secretary. I noted earlier that a key attribute that many with a bipolar condition have is a high degree of prescience. It's not limited, however, to those with that condition. Boris Johnson told his father when he was a child that he wanted to be the, quote, world king, and later told Charles Spencer that he wanted to be president of the United States, which was technically possible as Boris's father had given him both UK and US passports. Churchill had a very high level of prescience and had a similar story. At 16, he said to his only friend at Harrow that he would later command the defences of London. His quote, I will save the capital and the empire. At 23, he wrote his first and only book of fiction called Savrola, in which the hero figure predicts a world conflagration, then saves the capital from a tyrant, only later to be dismissed from office. How's that for prescience? But a sense of prescience doesn't guarantee the predicted result. When 18 and being chased by his brother Jack and a cousin in a fox and hare game, Churchill thought he could escape by leaping off a bridge and sliding down an adjacent fir tree to land gently on the grass. He stated that he felt invincible and he could see the result before he leapt. He leapt, he missed the tree, and instead he landed on hard ground, ruptured a kidney, and nearly died. I've seen brilliant prescience-based achievements in a number of those with a bipolar disorder. I've also seen the dangers of prescience in many such patients. The man who put thousands of dollars on red 23 at roulette, being absolutely convinced that it would land, or the share trader who lost several million dollars precipitously trading a fortune at 3 a.m. having had a clairvoyant burst. Prescience operated in much of Churchill's life, even, for example, when he played bridge. You too. He played bridge intuitively, didn't stick to the rules, and he just loved doubling and redoubling, convinced that he could win. He lost a lot of money. Distinguished psychiatrist academic Kay Jamison, one of the two authors of the seminal academic book titled Manic Depressive Illness, and a great academic, and who described her own bipolar 1 illness in a wonderful book called An Unquiet Mind, wrote in another of her books, which is called Touch with Fire, that the manic depressive temperament is marked by, quotes, fierce energy, high mood, and quick intelligence, a sense of the visionary and the grand, a restless and feverish temperament, and with such people often appearing to the world as mercurial, intemperate, volatile, troubled, or stormy. I'd suggest those descriptors capture Churchill. Winston was a hero, a true warrior, a man who came alive when under enemy fire. It was his antidepressant before, in late life, he actually was put on a psychostimulant, dexamethasone, by his managing doctor, Lord Moran. And those psychostimulants actually preceded the first formal antidepressants. And only with that was he able to get up in the House of Commons. His depression in those years were very, very significant. He was a true warrior, as I said, a wonderful communicator and one of our greatest leaders. In my view, he had a bipolar 2 disorder, and that during mood elevating highs, he made decisions more commonly based on prescience rather than on logic. And then, disinhibited, he would adopt a break or breakthrough philosophy, both a reflection of his personality and of his highs. In World War I, he free-ranged with some dreadful consequences. In World War II, there were safeguards in place. I think that's a very simple explanation, but maybe an important one in explaining the huge differences. And wouldn't a dissection like this make for an intriguing play or film or Netflix series? Sigh.
Thank you, Professor Gordon Parker. The reason the professor is here tonight is that I read this piece by Natasha Robinson in The Australian, and I was talking about it to Gordon earlier, how she got onto him. And he was actually being interviewed about a project you've got up running, which is about mental health and whatever. But she was so absorbed in the story of Churchill that the article didn't mention the program that Gordon wanted to be advertised, and just got caught up in this notion of Winston Churchill being bipolar. So to what extent is this bipolar thing? Is it a plus or a minus? And if we see it in Winston Churchill as a kind of plus in what he achieved, how do we go about dealing with it when it isn't always a plus? I mean, what and how important has it been for those that lead the nations?
Yes, in a sense, a predictable question, but a very difficult one to answer. I think my simple answer would be you ride with the pluses, you take advantage of the creativity, but you do have the checks and balances to make sure that you're not making a disastrous decision. And then when you are in the down phase, then one needs to be very, very careful about taking any actions at all, because the depressed mood can result in some pretty scarifying and negative judgments. I'm not aware of any great writer with a biological depression, melancholia we call it, or in bipolar depressed mood, and again that's melancholia, ever writing a great book in the depressed phase. I know there are some exceptions that when I put this out, somebody will say, well, look, you know, what about X or what about Y? But basically, it's a state of high conservation where people are just fighting to stay alive. They shouldn't make judgments at those times. But I think I've more focused on the advantages and the disadvantages of the highs. And that's where a stay well plan comes into operation. And so what we try to do is give the individual some understanding of the risks based on their background, get them to identify their early warning signals. For a high, it's most commonly starting to spend money or not sleeping, and then to have a pre-set stay well plan in place. And that can involve all sorts of things, you know, fairly predictable things. One more imaginative strategy a patient told me was that when he went high, his wife would put his credit card in the ice freezer. It sounds very simple, and you think, well, okay, what he had to do is to put it in hot water. But when he was high, he couldn't wait for 30 seconds. So that strategy actually prevented him from blowing his credit card. So you need a lot of imagination at times to come up with a stay well plan. But certainly, you know, dealing with VIPs with a bipolar disorder, you see a lot of very interesting consequences of irrational decision making at a very high level.
Thanks for a great talk. I'm not a psychiatrist, but I'm wondering about your talk, because it seemed to me that if Churchill didn't drink alcohol much during the Dardanelles campaign, but he drank heaps from 1940 on, could it have been that what saved him in 1940 was the grog he was drinking?
I doubt it. Are you sure that he commenced drinking in 1940?
That was my question. I mean, if he didn't drink a lot in 15 and he did drink in 1940, I mean, it's the Flann O'Brien answer to everything. If you keep your brain liquid with alcohol, you'll make better decisions.
Yeah.
Worth a play.
Or a film.
or Netflix.
I think he tended to absorb alcohol because he just kept drinking across the day. And there have been various estimates ranging up to 30 standard drinks a day one estimate that I've come across. So he drank a huge amount of alcohol. The post-mortem showed that his liver was fine. It was his brain that he had severe dementia vascular dementia, strokes in his last few years. So I suspect he was a rapid metabolizer. And that is a condition essentially affecting about 5 to 10% of the Australian population, where antidepressants don't have any effectiveness at all. And most psychiatrists aren't aware of this, and they try antidepressant after antidepressant, when in fact, if you're a rapid metabolizer, then it's all being excreted and you have to apply other strategies. So Churchill's capacity to drink alcohol at that level, irrespective of whether he was high or low or euthymic, suggests to me that he was probably a rapid metabolizer and the alcohol didn't do much, supported by the fact that his liver was normal at pathology.
Thank you. Thanks again, Gordon. So there's kind of two questions here. One is perhaps specifically to Churchill, but you might talk generally about bipolar. What is the typical time frame or the length of phase of the downs and the ups? And there'll be, I'm sure there'll be variability, but perhaps you can comment on that.
I'll take it one at a time, Will. They'll come back to you. There's no typical time period. The diagnostic manual stipulates that, in fact, to have be diagnosed as having bipolar 1 and have a manic high, mania episodes must last for 7 days. And for bipolar 2 hypomanic episodes, they must last for 4 days. But in fact, if you apply those criteria, and they were put to try to overcome the risk of overdiagnosis, if you impose those, you miss 60% of people with a true bipolar 2 disorder and 40% of those with a bipolar 1. So many people are sawtoothing on a regular basis. Their highs might only last half a day, and yet I've had a patient where their high lasted 30 years. So there's no regular pattern to it at all. But the key point I make is the DSM criteria that they have to last a certain day is dangerously incorrect. And as one of my colleagues said, it's rather similar to saying, well, we'll define a hurricane by how long it lasts. You know, you don't. So Will had a second one, Gerard, if it's okay.
No, I think we'll go.
Okay,
we'll
thanks.
Yes, I'd just like to ask this question. This is from The Spectator, and Prue Leith is talking about a biography called No More Champagne by David Luff, which is yet another biography of Winston Churchill, but at this time seen through his financial tribulations. Neither Churchill nor Clementine could ever economize. She spent a fortune on clothes, he on champagne, cigars, grand accommodation, and gambling. Somehow he managed Europe's destiny while on a constant financial knife edge. How does this behavior fit in with a bipolar personality?
It doesn't of necessity. It would only fit in and be a symptom or a action or a consequence if he only spent excessively during a high and he was parsimonious when he was depressed and didn't spend anything when he was in a normal mood state. The evidence seems to suggest that he was a spendthrift right through his life. Yeah, right. And he was in huge debt. And some of the deals that he negotiated where he would report on, political matters, despite there being enforced periods before they could be put to any book, he would cut deals of over £100,000. And even then, he was generally in debt for much of his time.
Graham Sligo, just on a read of history, I agree with what you said about the First World War, but in the Second World War, many of the minders, as you refer to them, are not externally imposed. It seems to me that they come from a degree of self-knowledge of Churchill's own mistakes in the past and his development.
Yes.
So, for example, his appointment of General Sir Alan Brooke, a rational person who would temper, and the huge arguments that occurred within the Chiefs of Staff Committee, Churchill's own self-imposition that he would only issue instructions in writing and that he would not issue an instruction if all three of the chiefs of staff and Ismay were opposed.
Mm.
So on self-knowledge and, you know, development of learning as you go along.
Yes, thank you. No, it's an important observation and extends what I was suggesting, that in fact there were protective strategies in play. Yep.
Thank you. What's the role in, you know, brain chemicals that we hear about in this, number one? And number two, when you're medicating, is there always the chance that you're going to take away all that creative energy that people have? For example, that Churchill had.
Yeah.
If he'd been medicated with drugs that we use nowadays.
What's going on in the brain? The woman I referred to, Kay Jamison, she and a co-author have written the definitive book on manic depressive illness. It's actually called Manic Depressive Illness. There are 320 pages on the biology of changes in the brain. But the most parsimonious explanation for a long period of time has been neurotransmitter and more loculated to one called dopamine, basically saying when people are high, they've got too much dopamine, when they're low, not enough dopamine. Now it's there's big extension into inflammatory models that are going on, and that's leading to new opportunities for differing treatment options. Coming to your second question, that is one of the commonest things that people will say to us as psychiatrists, creative individuals. If I go on a mood stabilizer, will I lose my creativity? And I published a paper on that very topic about 3 months ago, actually, in an Australian journal. There's only been one formal study, and that was looking at creative people put on lithium. And the study suggested only 10% found it worse, 30% distinctly worse, 30% said it compromised their creativity, 30% improved their creativity. But more recent reviews, and I've tried to overview them in my paper, suggest that lithium is particularly worrying for most people with bipolar disorder, even though it may be the drug of choice. For people with bipolar 2, the general recommendation, again, is lithium. But I find it toxic for bipolar 2 patients, and I have another option. And probably 50 or 60% of people with a bipolar disorder have significant cognitive problems on lithium. And again, it may be foggy concentration, inability to retain, et cetera, et cetera. Epilum, another mood stabilizer, has a slight effect on cognitive functioning. The only one with a clear bill of health is lamotrigine, which is my favorite drug for bipolar 2 disorder. And there have actually been some intriguing studies suggest that it may improve creativity. I don't think that's possible. I think it's probably an artifact of the research. So it's a question asked by all creative people, and it's a very obvious one. You know, if their bipolar is lifting them into higher level of functioning, then why would you want to lose it? Yeah.
Gordon, it's out of context with Winston Churchill, but in the modern era, have you had any thoughts about Donald Trump and his situation? He's going to, I mean, I know it's not, but I think we've got to be concerned about the possibility. Have you had any thoughts about him at all?
Oh, I've had lots of thoughts, and it's the commonest question I get when I'm playing golf with somebody, apart from the second one is, I think my daughter's son has ADHD. Would you be able to get somebody to help them? But I don't think it's appropriate for a psychiatrist to comment on any living person, particularly when there's a risk of it being a negative comment.
Thank you very much for a very interesting discussion. We look forward to the play appearing on Netflix. It used to be the case that politicians had relatively long careers, less so now, but those that did quite often matured, and their experience meant that they performed quite well towards the end of their political lives. In fact, quite often, you know, you see a president or a prime minister after they've finished office, and they make a lot of sense that maybe they didn't earlier. Churchill, of course, was a young man in a hurry in World War I, and then he had 20 plus years experience before he again had power in World War II. to what degree could his behaviour have been influenced by the experience that he'd gained, or does bipolar just sort of sweep that away and become dominant in behaviour?
What a great question. I obviously don't know the answer, but I don't think it had much to do with his bipolar. I think it had more to do with the man, a man who had extraordinary talents, you know, writing as an historian, it's quite extraordinary. And yet, look at his early years. He failed his entrance exam in primary school at Harrow. His father had to put pressure on the school to take him on. He was judged to be the dumbest boy in his year at Harrow. He wasn't doing anything productive until his late teens. And there are lots of reasons for it, mainly psychological, not bipolar. But there was the family gene to be successful. And I think he wanted particularly to take over from Randolph's destiny, presumed destiny. Randolph had been viewed, his father, as the most likely next prime minister and was a superb politician. But on his Bucks night, he was put in company with a rather problematic woman, and he developed syphilis, and he therefore had that impact on his political career when he was quite a young man, and as you would know, died at a very young age as a consequence. But nevertheless, Randolph was put up as a shining light. And there was that film about Churchill, and I'm just desperately trying to think of the name, and the final image is where Churchill has a dream, it's a recurring dream, essentially of his father. And his father is now walking through Churchill's life and saying, essentially, what did you do, lad? As if there was no awareness that his son had achieved great things. So I suspect personality was in play for Churchill's life. He wanted to show he could be as good as anybody else in the family, if not better. And I think we should applaud him for that. And that would be my thinking, but not bring bipolar into the story there at all.
Yeah, thanks, Gordon. Wonderful talk. Thank you. My question is around this, what came up earlier about self-awareness by Churchill, what was going on here, given the lack of knowledge around this area of science and medicine. Clearly, he had great sensitivity to the fact that he had depression and used the word black dog. He wrote letters back in 1911 to his wife, Clementine, talking about depression and thankful that his black dog hadn't been around just recently. So there was that level of self-awareness, but on the other side, on the manic high side, there were these disasters we saw, as you've articulated so well, in World War One. Does that mean that he couldn't differentiate around, and that he was totally unaware of these manic highs?
Yes, and he wasn't alone. As I said, bipolar 2 wasn't a recognised condition in those days, and he never had psychotic manic episodes, whereas his ancestors, the Dukes of Marlborough that had bipolar, had the full-blown psychotic manic depressive illness. He would have been aware of that. He would have been aware that he had mood swings, but he probably tried to reassure himself and say, but I'd never have delusions. You know, I never believe that I'm Jesus Christ or I'm talking to the devils or whatever. And I think he probably then failed to diagnose that he had a clinical condition. And of course, many people at the time would put his depression down to his dreadful upbringing. Randolph was humiliating when he spent any time around him. Churchill's mother basically ignored him. She was out having affairs with, you know, people in Buckingham Palace and elsewhere. He was a largely ignored child, and that's why his nanny was so loved by him, that she was the only person who cared for him. So I think he would have interpreted, if he had a sense of awareness, and he would have had some level of psychological awareness, not too much, where it worked in his favour, I think he would have put it down to, you know, the dreadful family that he was being raised by, that would cause him to feel great sadness and depression and emptiness and unloved and whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks, Gordon. This may be an overgeneralisation, but the level of public scrutiny that politicians were under in 1940, you know, the World War II period, relative to today, was, I'd assume, would be nowhere near, you know, the level that politicians face today. Would it be possible then for a politician in today's, you know, world to have minders, and particularly through those down periods, be out of action?
Yes, yes, and that does occur. Yep, yep. Yep.
Did his physician look...
Just speak into it. Eat the ice cream.
Did his physician, Lord Moran, throw any insights on any clinical analysis on this issue?
No. Lord Moran was a rather self-important man, and he's been, I think, appropriately heavily criticised for writing a biography on Churchill when he was Churchill's physician. He blew a rule of confidentiality. But he never picked up on bipolar or anything akin to that. No, no, he wasn't a very good doctor, I don't think.
So good. My follow-up question on the first one relating to the phase or the length of time of the phase of these periods relates back to Churchill specifically, and I've been to the Churchill's war rooms in London, which everyone should go if they ever get a chance. But do you think, or have you had a chance to look at whether you feel that he might have had a few months of amazing periods, in critical parts of the war, or you just don't know enough about whether he had short and long periods at that time?
We just don't know. Tom, you had a great question before we started. So Tom is essentially...
It was about Thanks. How Churchill managed his workload during...
So that. Tom is effectively saying, if what you said, Gordon, tonight, there's a man with these dramatic and severe mood perturbations, how could he have achieved so much and got away with so much and shown such intelligence? Now, I said I wouldn't talk about, as a psychiatrist, anyone who's alive, but I'm now going to break that rule and talk about Stephen Fry. And the reason I feel comfortable about doing it is that Stephen Fry has talked about his bipolar disorder for 2 decades now. And in fact, about 10 years ago, he was touring Australia and he had 2 basic gigs in each state. One night he'd talk about subject X and the other night he'd talk about his bipolar disorder. So he's talked about it publicly and he's written about it, so I feel comfortable about referencing him. Look at Fry's incredible intelligence, covering so many topics, you know, English in the book An Ode Less Travelled. Look at his more recent books, Mythos, on Greek mythology. The man is absolutely extraordinary with his intelligence. Look at him in so many roles on television. Look at him on Q&A. Here's a man who's had mood swings of incredible severity, and he's described suicide attempts and all sorts of things. And yet he's kept on going and performed at a high level. So if you don't mind me using Fry as an exemplar, because I have huge respect for him, I think he is a great exemplar of how you can have a bipolar condition and still achieve at a very high level.
Thank you very much for an inspiring talk. Currently, there is still an enormous amount of stigma around mental illness, and especially bipolar, because people just don't understand what you've just described. I have known of employers who have actively done gone in two directions. One is to employ people with bipolar disorder because of their hires, because they're so productive. And the, of course, the opposite, to not employ them because of that. I wonder if an employer came to you and said, what should I do, Professor Parker? I have this brilliant man here or this brilliant woman here and they experience bipolar disorder. What should I do? Should I employ them or not?
I think for most of the time it would be completely inappropriate for me to make a response to that request. If it was a patient, then it would almost be a total no-go zone. If, however, the patient said to me, look, my employer is keen to have a conversation, I would then try to find out what were the parameters of the conversation and would it be potentially beneficial. And then I might have the conversation as long as my patient informed me and made a judgment when their mood was stable and was in the same room at the same time. Then I think it could work in a positive way. But I disagree with you slightly. Comparing where we were 2 decades ago, I think Australia has destigmatised the mood disorders better than any other country in the world. And again, I think Black Dog made a big contribution to that. And one of the ways that we advanced it was by getting sportsmen and politicians talk about it openly. Sportsmen being the far more successful ones. And so I think even though there are still problems, they're far less than they were. However, when I make a diagnosis of a bipolar condition for a person, I will usually say to them, just keep in mind who you should tell. I personally believe you should tell, you know, your parents if they're a young person, or your partner, or your future partner. But whether you tell your employer or anybody else, you need to be a bit careful because sometimes bipolar 2 is just seen as bipolar, which is seen as manic depression, which is seen as madness, etc. So I think we still need to be cautious, but like you, I do hear some, I haven't heard anything quite as positive as your story, but I do hear many positive stories where the boss will say, now that they're aware that their employee's got bipolar, they cut them a lot of slack and they look after them with great care, knowing that these people are precious and can be highly productive.
This time. And tells me it's the final question, so it's from one of our Zoom people who makes the point that what's a psychiatrist doing writing plays? So what's your background in that sort of field? Why did you, I mean, did you do this at school or university, or did you just do it in your practice room so when it got quiet? Or
I was a very poor medical student and I thought that I would like to take up another career, so I wrote a book of fiction and I took it to a publisher, Lansdowne Press in Melbourne, and they said, you haven't got a track record. Your book's not bad, but you haven't got a track record. So I then went off and wrote for Mavis Branston, Oz Magazine, did cartoons for The Bulletin, did a number of other gigs, took it back. The book was published in 1966, and it was one of the most enjoyable experiences of my life. I experienced the muse when I was writing. So when I became a psychiatrist, I got distracted, felt that I should focus on that. But I decided, why not write another book of fiction after 50 years? And so I did write a book, which was published in 2018, a book of fiction called In Two Minds, where Stephen Fry made a wonderful support line on the front cover. And I have had one play published. It was put on at La Mama in Melbourne, and we did bring it to the Sydney Theatre Company for a performance. And I've done other pieces of writing over time. And I still just find, and I'm now writing another book, Flat Chat, I still find writing a great pleasure, and I'm still struck by the phenomenon of what it's like when the muse is in operation.
Well, we've had quite a night, from Winston Churchill to Stephen Fry to the various affairs of his mother and so forth. Thank you for that. That was a sterling effort. And the combination of your scientific background and medical background and the historical background made that quite a treat.